You should have in your, at your place a one-page overview of the public outreach process, which I'll review briefly. If not, no worries. I will cover it extemporaneously here from the dais. Just to give you a brief update on the committee, we held our first meeting in September. As you may know, we have a 17-member committee representing key stakeholder groups, parents, teachers, administrators, school board members, the business community, and other communities of interest. We've held 5 meetings so far, just about every other week, excepting the holidays. And we've finished the first of 3 planned public outreach endeavors. The first phase, which we call the pre-design phase, occurred in October. It consisted of 12 focus groups split among 4 parent groups, 3 teacher groups, 4 administrator groups, and 1 student group. I should note that the parent groups were organized by the Parent Teacher Association and Self-Enhancement, Inc., and they included 1 Spanish language only group and 1 group of parents of color. The 3 teacher groups were organized by the Oregon Education Association, and the 4 administrator groups were organized by the Confederation of School Administrators. Following those focus groups, I prepared a report providing some preliminary findings regarding the potential content and design of the report card. Those results have been considered by the committee, and we're now in the process of developing the second phase of public outreach, which is around prototype testing. For this phase, we will engage in an online survey. There'll be 3 sample sources for this particular survey. There'll be targeted sample aimed at parents statewide. There will be ad hoc sample that will be solicited via social media and a web banner ad campaign. And there will also be email solicitations from the key stakeholder groups represented on the committee and other partner groups. We are in the process of selecting vendors to execute the requisite activities. I will be writing the survey and doing the final reporting, given my 20-plus years in market research. So I'm providing that service kind of outside my typical contract. I should also note that I conducted 9 of the 12 focus groups and then solicited the help of other experienced volunteers to conduct the others.
You're just handy to have.
Thank you, Coach Yerhouse. And following the execution of the second phase, in which we'll test reactions to the current Oregon report card and 2 potential prototypes, I will feed those results back to the committee, and we'll undergo 1 more phase of public outreach, which will also consist of focus groups similar in design and content to the first set of groups that I conducted in October, as well as there'll be another online survey, again, to provide greater geographic diversity in terms of the responses. So that is the current plan as it stands. I'd be happy to entertain questions from co-chairs or committee members.
Can you give us a little idea of the direction of some of the questions and what you're trying to draw out of them?
Co-chair Huffman, committee members, the primary rationale, again, for the first survey is to set a benchmark in terms of the current Oregon School Report Card. So I want to get some understanding of the general public's reactions to the current design and content. We have some indication, based on the focus groups, that parents in particular have a hard time understanding the content and don't regard the current report card as especially actionable. So we're looking toward report cards developed by other states, particularly Illinois, as potential illustratives that we can use to inform our redesign process. The questionnaire in particular gets at not only reactions to the current report card overall, but also singles out each section on a page-by-page basis to understand the relative importance of the various measures and their importance going forward. The survey will also cover, as I said, two prototypes. Each respondent will actually see only one of the two in order to avoid respondent fatigue. The questions for the prototypes will mirror those for the existing report card so that we can compare and contrast reactions to the existing report card and the first proposed prototype.
Okay. Representative Kump.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I apologize for being late, but did you give a synopsis of how many people attended the public meetings? What were they well attended? Did you have actual numbers? And if you already gave us that information, I'll get it from the committee staff.
Co-chairs, Representative Kump, I did not give that information earlier, so that was a very timely question. We had 99 participants in the focus groups. We purposely limited the groups to no more than 10, so that in a 90-minute session, each of the participants had a basically equal amount of time to respond, about 20 minutes each or so.
And you had, follow-up? And you had six of these meetings?
Co-chairs, Representative Kump, we had 12 focus groups in total. They were very well attended. We had full participation in each meeting, and it generated a number of, it was a great deal of consensus for the most part. There were a few areas of disagreement, but we tested 52 separate metrics in the course of those groups.
Thank you.
Okay. Good afternoon again, Co-Chair Huffman and Gessler and committee members. I'll reintroduce myself for the benefit of those who were unable to be here at the beginning. I'm Gail Rasmussen. I'm the president of the Oregon Education Association, and I am so very pleased to be before you today to discuss our role in shepherding the design of the new education report card. You know, the state of Oregon has embarked upon this project in two different venues, the Legislative Branch's Accountable Schools Task Force, as well as the Executive Branch Report Card Task Force. And we've been honored as OEA to participate in both of them. Our participation reflects OEA's keen interest in getting this right. Historically, Oregon's first school report cards were passed as a means to punish and to blame shift, rather than to really serve as a valid tool for parents, communities, and policymakers. And at the national level, the now infamous No Child Left Behind law took the same approach, focusing too intently on the high-stakes standardized test and the punitive measures against schools, administrators, educators, and the students themselves. So we believe that true and meaningful accountability does not have to go in that direction, but to do it right, we need to look at all of those moving parts. So, what do we measure? And who do we measure? What is the quality of the tool that we use to measure? Do we teach things that are hard or expensive to measure, particularly when we are so strapped for adequate resources? Who is held responsible for the matrix that indicate a problem? And is the responsibility placed equally on the unwilling student, the unsupportive parent, the underfunded system, society's condition of increased poverty? How can a district truly, truly have a report card that accurately reflects the climate, the culture, the conditions, and the output of a school without the unintended consequences of lowering staff and student morale, driving out the best and the brightest? And how can it do so without driving away potential home buyers, even lowering property values, as has happened in some communities? These are just a few of the questions that we have considered as we attempt to help shape a document that is comprehensive enough to meaningfully reflect the profile of each school without being too long, too jargon-filled, or too unresponsive to parent interest in the critical information. So, among the concerns we still have is that the central data remain summative test results, which we believe is problematic. And given that NCLB waiver was granted on the promise that Oregon would continue to follow this path, however, we were not able to alter that element. We still have questions about the ultimate tool Oregon will rely upon to measure student achievement and how it will assign responsibility based on reading and math matrix alone. But having said that, we have been pleased, very pleased with the process of the task force because it has truly sought a broad range of input from diverse constituencies despite the challenges of a hurried timeline. And we have worked to sponsor focus groups of educators to provide input in the first place, in the first phase of the process, and will continue to offer avenues for input as the report card drafts are and become available for review. At the end of the day, though, it is our hope that this tool will be graphically pleasing, that it will be easy to read, and will contain the kind of information that reflects fair measures of important aspects of public schools, aspects that help build a picture of assets, challenges, resources, inputs, and processes for educating our students. And we hope it will not be used in a punitive, competitive, or misguided manner by reporters, policymakers, or reformers. One final thought, if I may. The Oregon Education Association believes that the achievement of a high-quality education system for all students is contingent upon necessary funding, resources, and support. It is our hope that the new Oregon report card, once completed and deployed, will convey a picture of the condition of our joint efforts to deliver a high-quality education to our students within the constraints of the available resources, and will lead us to thoughtfully make adjustments not only in the condition of our schools, but also in the conditions of our communities, our budgets, and our policies that either fail or pass the test of adequacy. Thank you so much for the opportunity to share our thoughts today.
Questions? I was going to say, Representative Comp, come on, you got to have a question.
Co-Chair Hoffman, I've only been in legislature for 8 years, so I'm just at the bottom of my pyramid of questions. The question I have is, and I was trying to pull up Illinois' report card real quick, is there still going to be the quotient on there for adequate yearly progress? Is that still part of the waiver? The toughest thing that, or the most useless thing on the past report cards have been the actual formula for AYP. So what's the status of that?
Co-Chair Huffman, Co-Chair Gelser, Representative Comp. The NCLB waiver still requires the state to include 5 core summative metrics. 4 of those are based on OAKS.
Right.
Those metrics include both achievement and progress, with the 5th metric being actually a composite metric of the previous 4 and plus graduation. So those are the metrics which we have to use based on the NCLB waiver.
Mr. Chair, yes, and it's been a while and I refer to the 8 years. It's been eight years since I've been a school principal. We used to have a six-year window in order to calculate whether we were meeting adequate yearly progress or not. Is it still a span over time with its own metric and parentheses for year one? I mean, it was quite a math lesson when I learned all that.
Co-chairs, Representative Comp. I'm not sure of the exact number of years that are used to calculate NYP, but I do know that it's a longitudinal analysis. I will say that one aspect of the core metrics we're examining is the weighting scheme.
Right.
The current weighting scheme was based on Colorado's model because they were among the first states to adopt this type of report card system. So we're examining whether there is some mathematical rationale for the weighting system and determining the effect of alternate weights on the summative score.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you, David. It is not a simple calculation that I was aware of, and that I don't know how you explain that to parents, that even though our students are progressing in an upward trend, you're still not meeting adequate yearly progress. And it's just real tough to communicate that so that our students still feel good about themselves and our teachers feel good about themselves and our community say, yes, we're doing the right thing. So, yeah, the complexities are our biggest challenge.
Sure. Co-chair, Representative Comp, the committee is considering a number of alternate overall rating systems, but regardless of which system the committee ultimately recommends, I believe there is consensus on the committee now to disaggregate the summative metric. In other words, it won't just be a single score with no explanation, as has been reported in the past. Instead, there will be a score that's disaggregated into its constituent parts, and parents will be able to see on in which areas schools are doing either better or worse. And so that the summative metric is broken down in a way, hopefully, that will allow parents to better understand the progress that's being made at their school.
Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gil, could you talk a little bit more about appropriate uses of data on a report card? So a couple of the words that jump out are, could you give examples of punitive and competitive ways that we might use this data and contrast that to how we might take this data to improve student outcomes in our schools?
Co-chairs and committee and Representative Gessler, I think one of the things that we have to be very, very careful of is when students come to the classrooms and we test them, we are seeing evidence of these students not doing well simply because they're stressed about a test. So on any given day, those tests may not truly be as informative to helping these students to be understand and learn better. The other thing that I would say to the committee as a whole is, as we continue to grapple with how to best educate all of our students, taking them from where they are when they come to us, understanding that poverty is a real issue amongst our students, getting them to school on a very regular basis, having them adequately fed and clothed and ready to receive instruction, again, can skew whatever data information that could be gathered on any particular time in a collective. I think that we do a huge disservice if we use information that compares and contrasts in a way that it is not about improving and enhancing those students who have greater challenges, but comparing them unfairly with others who may have different advantages, that it causes us to see that as sometimes punitive, though in my heart of hearts, I believe all adults in this state want to see all of our students achieve at their very best.
Can I follow up? So, if kind of moving away from the Oaks data and looking at a graduation outcome. Mm-hmm. So, if we look at the data that we got the other week about our graduation rates, and we were to take 100 kids and look at who are those 32 that aren't graduating, 25 of those 32 would be low-income kids. So what would be the right way to use that data to honor those kids and do better at identifying those problems and moving forward?
Okay. Co-chair and committee members and Representative Gelsler, in a past life, in the school district, I worked with students who were attendance issues. They were often seen as throwaway kids. One of the things that I think needs to happen is to work with those families to understand truly what the challenges are. I believe also that not every youngster is ready to go to college at the end of 12, 13 years of education. Some students just move a little slower, and it takes a little longer to get to that point. But I do believe we have an obligation to prepare them to be the best that they can be, that they can also see themselves as contributing to our society, that we have pathways for them to also excel and be a part of the society. We don't often have the time or the resources to really delve into that, and though I believe that schools are sometimes the be-all, end-all for some of our students because we're the most stable thing in their lives with caring adults, folks who will feed them, folks who will help them achieve at their levels. We need to honor that.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
I see no more questions. Any closing comments? Going once?
Co-chairs, committee, the one thing I would add is that because the core metrics are predetermined based on the NCLB waiver, the committee is spending much of its time on providing appropriate context. So to Representative Gelser's earlier question, we're looking at trying to provide some qualitative information about each individual school so that parents believe or feel like this information is both relevant and actionable. To that end, we're looking at things like including demographic breakdowns by ethnicity, by the percentage of students on IEPs, by the percentage of students that fall under low income that are low English proficiency, those types of things, to ensure that parents understand the context for the summative score. We think that because the scores are challenging to interpret on their own, that we need to provide as much context as possible. We're also looking at, for instance, having a personal letter from the principal for each report card that characterizes the previous year's goals, the degree to which the school reached those goals, and then setting the goals for the following year for the next report card, so that parents again have some kind of context for those summative scores.
Great, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Comp. I knew David was going to open it up for more.
Well, we are asked. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are asking schools to tell us what their and part of their achievement compact. We're going to a whole new language for education, and so the letter you're referring to from the principal may well clearly identify the goals of their previous year or this year for that they're sharing with us as a legislative body on their achievement compact. Is that correct?
Co-chairs, Representative Comp, yes, that is the ideal situation. We're trying to design the report card in the context of the achievement compacts as well as the federal designation for focus, priority, and model schools.
Mm-hmm. Just the last metaphor. We used to be always doing reform movements in Woodburn School District to help us help our students achieve, and we likened it to building the plane in the air. And I commend all the work that you're doing, because our goal was to eventually let the plane sit on the ground and build it once in a while, because part of our task force on school accountability, when we had input from people in the field, the challenges that all of our professionals in our schools are facing right now today are incredible, and we just keep asking them to do more, and I know they can only stay up there in the clouds for so long, and we really need to help them out. So thank you.
All right, thank you. Appreciate
you
coming, giving us the update. I need to close off that informational meeting, and then should I recess for just a second so we can discuss our next?
We could go on and do the bill introduction.
Okay, because I don't see Representative Harker here. Okay, going to close the informational meeting on the update from the steering committee on the school report card, and I think we are going to go into a work session, a possible work session.
It'll be a work session.
Okay. Going to open up a work session on introduction of committee legislative concepts. And Victoria, if you want to do, are you going to do the introduction, or is Aaron going to slip?
Sure, I can do it.
You're going to do it? Okay.
Whoever's here can do it.
And I am going to slip this to Co-Chair Gelzer, because I want to slip out and get some information real quick. So
okay.
I will be right back.
Okay.
Thank you.
You want me to go ahead?
Yeah, so, Victoria, do you want to go ahead and provide this summary? And just a brief comment really quickly. When we do, it's been a while since we've introduced the committee bills, but generally we put them in. It's not a statement of support or opposition of anyone on the committee when we put them in. It's just a matter of putting it in the pipeline, and if you vote to introduce the committee bill, nobody should take that as a sign of support of the bill by any member of the committee or opposition to the bill either.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. The committee should have these summaries available to them for the purposes of the audience. These are the legislative concepts currently before the committee. LC 886 relating to misconduct by school employees clarifies applicability of provisions relating to misconduct of school employees. LC 1447 relating to the practice of psychology makes changes to educational and training qualifications necessary to be licensed to practice psychology and requires the Oregon State Board of psychologist examiners to accept the doctoral credentials of an applicant for a psychologist license if that applicant holds a doctoral degree in psychology from an institution accredited by one of the six regional accrediting agencies recognized by the United States Secretary of Education, established to accredit senior institutions of higher education. LC 1940 relating to career schools authorizes adoption of fees for certain activities related to career schools. LC 1944 relating to discipline of career school licensees clarifies terms of probation and suspension for licensees of career schools. LC 1946 relating to the regulation of career schools establishes requirements to transition school between career school regulated by Department of Education and career school regulated by agency of executive department, allows the superintendent of public instruction to grant exemption to authorize agency to regulate certain career schools. LC 1949 relating to career school civil penalties allow superintendent of public instruction to retain reasonable costs related to investigation and assessment of career school civil penalties. LC 1953 relating to career schools allows State Board of Education to adopt rules related to general governance and operation of career schools and modifies training requirements for hair design, barbering, aesthetics, and nail technology. LC 1956 relating to finances of career schools requires State Board of Education to adopt minimum standards related to financial soundness of owner of career school, allows board to consider financial condition of owner of career school when establishing payment schedule for tuition protection fund. LC 1959 relating to agent of career schools expands definition of agent for career schools. LC 2121 relating to disciplinary policies of schools establishes standards and goals for school policies related to discipline, suspension, or expulsion. Requires each district school board shall adopt written policies for the discipline, suspension, or expulsion of any refractory student, and requires each district school board to adopt written policies on managing students who threaten violence or harm in public schools. LC 2418 relating to documented history of student for purpose of high school completion removes the requirements related to assessments for extended diplomas.
So you have the gavel.
What do we do now? Do we ask
you
for
can
a motion?
You can open for a discussion, or you can ask for a motion.
How about first a motion and then a discussion?
Representative Huffman.
Okay. Madam Co-Chair, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills.
Yeah, you need to read them. Sorry.
Yeah. Why is that? Okay. LCs 886. Do I need to read that too? Okay. LCs 886. 1447, 1940, 1944, 1946, 1949, 1953, 1959, 2121, and 2418.
So Representative Huffman moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 886, LC 1447, LC 1940, LC 1944, LC 1946, LC 1949, LC 1953, LC 1959, LC 2121, LC 2418, LC 1956.
And I meant to say LC 1956 in my motion, Madam Co-Chair. If I didn't, I will.
I heard it. It was quiet.
Okay, good.
But you moved LC 1956. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I do have a question. And of course, I think, we have a practice of introducing, approving bills that have been introduced as committee bills and getting going into the process. But, I noticed that a few of these bills are, really related to higher education, and not to be, not to seem overly proprietary about that, but why are these education committee bills?
I can answer that question. They were sent to us by Tim Inman, who asked us to put them in. They were bills that were in the education committee last session. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And I just wanted to point out that on these committee bills, as any others, it doesn't mean anybody's buying into supporting them or adopting them or saying they're going to do a yes vote. It just allows them to be brought into the committee and vetted throughout the process.
Great. And just a question for committee staff, LC 2121, that's the most updated draft that came back from Legislative Council today, yes?
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
All right, any further discussion?
I have a question.
Representative Conner.
Any sense of why these are being introduced as committee bills instead of being introduced by individual legislative sponsors?
I do not know. At this point in the session, it's not uncommon to have them as committee bills. I believe they were all committee bills last time.
This many? Is it? Do we typically have this many committee bills?
Yeah.
Okay.
Any further discussion? Representative Huffman?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just to follow up on Representative Conger's line of talk, it doesn't mean that they're going to be vetted less or that they come with any particular endorsement. One of these happens to be one of my bills. And as I talked to folks about it, the general consensus was it wasn't a controversial bill and probably wouldn't be, and so we could introduce it here. It doesn't mean it's going to get passed out of committee. It'll be vetted like everything else, and I won't make it a secret that it's my bill, and my hope and assumption would be that as we move forward, that all of these bills will know where they come from and what the purpose of them is and what the goal is.
Okay. And they certainly all will require advocates to come and ask that they be heard. And to Representative Dimbro's point, the Speaker will have to refer the bills to committee, so where they're introduced does not necessarily mean that's where they land in terms of where they're heard during the regular session either. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the introduction of this slate of committee bills? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered, and the measures are introduced as committee bills. Should we recess for 10 minutes until our
to
panel
find
comes?
Our next.
Oh, are they?
Yeah.
Okay.
So maybe let's recess for 5 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah, does that?
Then a drink.
So come back at about 5 to 2. Okay, so we'll recess for 5 minutes.
start.
Okay. Going to open up an informational meeting on the report from the Joint Interim Task Force on STEM Access and Success, the STEM group. That's a mouthful. House Bill 4056. I was at a STEM thing recently, and I said, why isn't it METS or...
METS?
Yeah, it went over that well there, too.
I thought it was something else.
STEM.
Okay.
STEM.
So, initially, Representative Harker will call you up, and Deb, if you want to join in, was it Savannah? Also, the, okay.
I can.
Okay. Savannah, great to have you here.
Thank you.
For those of you that were at the Leadership Summit a week ago today, we got to hear from Savannah, so glad to have you here and welcome. And you don't have nearly, well, of course, we're being broadcast live, so who knows? There could be tens of thousands out there hovering around the monitor watching us, but we're going to assume for the purposes of this room that it's far fewer than you spoke to last week. So anyway, welcome, and Representative Harker, take it away.
Thank you, Chair Huffman. Co-chairs and committee members, thanks so much for having us here today. I am, for the record, Representative Chris Harker from House District 34, which is half of Beaverton and Cedar Hills area. We are here today representing the task force that was created in our previous session, 2012 House Bill 4056 authorized this task force. And it had great strength, I think, due to the wonderful commitments of many people from many disciplines, all pertinent to the task at hand. And you ask why STEM is not METS. I think we're supposed to identify all acronyms that we use. So STEM, for those who may not know, stands for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And the goal, as assigned by House Bill 4056, was to encourage students to pursue STEM careers. The committee that the task force that I referred to had 16 appointed members. It included people from all over the disciplines relevant to this. We have a student, we had a higher education student, we had teachers, representatives of after-school provider organizations, Oregon Department of Education, industry, and higher ed. Many of those organizations are represented here today, and it's why I'm not going to talk through this whole thing myself, because while I spent a good deal of time in a STEM career in the business that I created and as a faculty member in physiology, these folks are in the trenches at all different levels right now. So we have a report that we have presented to you. I believe you have copies of a few different documents, one of which is our report. It was a collaborative effort, came out of four full task force meetings and more than 20 meetings of the work groups that were created within the task force. Each of those work groups brought back recommendations in the areas that we were charged with addressing in the initial legislation, and we then coalesced through multiple iterations, bringing all of these things together in the report that you have before you. We want to tell you our assessment of the situation, and we've got some recommendations, some very detailed recommendations, and some pretty big asks, we understand, but we believe that the asks are justified by what will come out of this system that we hope to build and strengthen. Okay? We're looking to create a STEM council, and that council would be within the office of the Chief Education Officer, and I understand that Dr. Crew is coming in here after us. I don't know that there's going to be a direct tie-in, but we envision this as being under his direct supervision, and it would develop and coordinate as well as advance STEM learning and industry engagement. The council would set specific goals and priorities for STEM education, including, if we can create them, the oversight of STEM hubs. We get pretty darn detailed in some of what we're suggesting, not in the main body of the report, but in the appendices. We tried to make the report readable. to make our case well and clearly there without getting down into the weeds too much. We had an awful lot of detailed discussion, and that's necessary, but most of those details are included in the appendices, as I said. The task force recommends some really big picture changes in addition to some of the narrow, really focused items that we have. We think that the state needs to take advantage of education that can be delivered technologically, and that some of what's going to be proposed can't happen in all areas of the state unless we have better infrastructure than we have. And so we've got some recommendations along those lines as well. Last thing I'm going to say before handing this over is that in the appendices, we've got those details, and in Appendix B, we have included a reference to the arts. And some of you have asked me and asked others and asked yourselves why we talk about STEM sometimes and STEAM at other times, the difference between those being the A that represents the arts. And I've had conversations with some of the employers that are represented here, some of the other employers like that little shop in my district, Nike, that rely heavily on people who are technologically capable, but also have that other side of the brain going, the right brain going, that enables people to have creative approaches to the problems that they confront on an ongoing basis in many of these disciplines. And so we've got a reference to that in the appendix.
Representative Parker, were you excited last Monday when the governor actually included the A?
Yes, sir.
In the STEM?
Indeed, I was.
I don't know how many people picked up on that, and I'm going, oh, STEAM. Mm-hmm. We've graduated.
But yes. And I should say that while I was co-author on a piece that appeared in the Oregonian during the time that we were having these task force meetings, I was not the one who brought it up and said, we have to put the arts in here. I'm wholly in support of it, as anyone who knows me knows in advance. But we had a good discussion about it, and we've got some advice in there. So thank you. And Deb, take it away.
Thank you for sharing the microphone.
And remember to introduce yourselves, everyone.
Absolutely. So thank you to the committee today for letting us share some of the things that we learned from this and just the opportunity to have a task force. I'm Deborah Mumhill. I'm the executive director for FIRST for the Pacific Northwest. And most people here know me as FIRST Robotics. We run the robotics programs in the state of Oregon, along with Oregon University Systems. So this was my first experience on a task force. It was just fantastic people to work with, just great minds in the room, people who have boots in the trenches. And coming out of it, I came out with probably a handful of what I call Ericisms, and Eric Wilt-Mosler will be up here later. He's just a fun guy to work with and a fast mind to keep up with. So we're going to give you a little bit of background on this, but an Ericism is we don't want to spend too much time admiring the problem. We hope that everybody knows that STEM is a huge initiative, not only in Oregon, but it's been in our country with President Obama and Secretary of Education Arne Duncan. And having covered Washington as my job and watching what they've been doing with STEM up there for the last 7 years, it's really, really exciting to see the focus here in Oregon that is really starting to come around STEM P-20. So I'm going to walk us through some slides, just as some background. And many of you have probably seen this if you've seen some other testimonies. This is kind of what the STEM group is walking around with, showing that there's this leaky pipeline, that we have students coming out of our high schools, coming out of 8th, 9th grade classes. We know what their math scores are. But by the time we get them to the end of the pipeline, which is the job, we've lost a number of students for a number of different reasons out of the pipeline. Here's an example of the OAKS scores that they were taken at 10th grade, which OAKS also shows your science scores. And when we get to the bottom, again, as we go through high school and how many graduated from high school, and we get down to those actual STEM degrees, you'll see that only 2% were able to go into finish in those STEM degrees, whether they were interested in them, whether they crashed and burned in their college calculus class. We don't have all that data in this slide, but there are things that basically cause them to stumble and fall on their journey to that degree. So here's your math graduate, your 2011 status of students with combined math and science scores. And so the total was 3,256. And you can look at where they broke out into non-STEM degree certificates, the ones who are still enrolled, not enrolled, and then at the end of the day again, 452 ended up getting that STEM degree. So right now, what we know is less than 2% of all Oregon graduates are going into STEM, and less than 14% of our top math and science students are earning STEM degrees. And a big piece of that is they've lost that foundational piece that they need, the where they learn, I like math, or I can do math, or I can do science, has been lost kind of in those 5th through 12th grade years at some point. Right now, when you look at jobs in the United States, there is 1.7 STEM job for every one unemployed person, and there's 4.3 unemployed people for every one job out there. So as we look at unemployment figures, you can very much visualize and see where that shift needs to happen. When you look at the high-quality jobs, the STEM graduates and workers that will add value to our economy, and we're going to show about that through the earnings here in the upcoming slides, but graduate degrees, the difference in what they can earn between a STEM job and a non-STEM job with a degree is quite significant. And as we're moving into the legislative actions of 40-40-20, I think this slide really well sums up what we're looking at by the time we get to 2018 and the percent of jobs in the United States that are going to require that bachelor's degree, which is that green mark, the two-year degree, which is the middle part of our 40%, and then the high school diploma or less there is that orange color on the bottom. So you'll see we're trending with the 40-40-20 plan. We're trending pretty equally in step with what's happening nationally. Here's our Oregon 2008 distribution of STEM jobs, and so you'll see that the ones we'll have about 29% are going to need some college or associate's degree, and that could be also including an apprenticeship program. 43% will require a bachelor's degree, and about 22% a master's or doctorate or higher. So a big, big push going towards those post-secondary pieces as we're preparing students coming out of high school. And here's our 40-40-20 goal. So on the right is the goal of 2025. And when you look at that middle graph, that's where our young adults are right now in 2010. So the investment piece comes in that will probably increase, at least in these STEM careers, about a 6% investment in their state earnings, which is going to add $9 billion to the annual increase in personal income. So the change hopefully will jump from that almost $38,000 a year to $40,000, and that's probably a conservative estimate. So the annual increase is going to be $1.4 billion. To our general tax and fee revenues, which means by our projections that it's going to be close to $400 million extra into our general fund if we can boost what we're doing in STEM right now. So at a national priority, a lot of you guys probably know the White House initiatives are there, that we have the bipartisan and bicameral support for the issues in Congress, that there's many STEM priorities and grants that come out. There's the 21st CCLC starting new focus on STEM, and then there's the business interest in this, and we'll have Eric up in a minute talking about the business interest and where we're going. I think Representative Harker did a really nice job of talking about where our recommendations are around the council. The hubs as being a point of contact. We have industry in our state who's very passionate about this problem, but yet what's the pathway and what's the doorway to get to have reach to K-12, to have reach into the community colleges and higher ed. So right now there's want and there's will from both sides, but we're envisioning that this hub system locally and geographically will be the center points that will hopefully then make the points happen where we can bring industry in to support the teachers so that all of the STEM work isn't on their backs because we've asked a lot of them already, and how we can start working together and bringing those pieces kind of in a centralized area. And then there's lots of ways to skin a cat, but this is just one iteration or suggestion of possibly what our recommendations would look like. The pieces that I, just from my work, that I look at more than anything is we will have 44,000 jobs in Oregon that have to do with computers, computer science, or computer programming, and we had four students in the state of Oregon pass the AP computer science test last year. So those are things that we're hopefully we will absolutely address. We can't just put a student who's an 11th or 12th grader up taking a computer science class, never having had any programming in elementary or middle school. So we're hoping to be able to kind of bring all of this together to work with industry and jobs and work it backwards to what we need to be doing down in that K through 12 sector. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Savannah Loberger, who is fantastic and will kind of set the stage for what she sees in K through 12.
Remember to introduce yourself, Savannah.
Okay. I'd like to thank the co-chairs, Representative Gelzer and Representative Huffman, for allowing me to speak at this meeting, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Savannah Loberger. I'm from Hillsborough High School, and it was wonderful to be able to serve on the STEM Task Force, Access for Success, and I really learned a lot. To say the least. I am 16. I am a senior at my high school. I am the only girl in my engineering program that is going to graduate with the focus program of either, I'm graduating with both, but within the program, I am the only one that is going to have my cords for the industrial education for my class. With this said, I am a little tired of being the only girl in my programs. And if you saw my presentation at the Oregon Business Leadership Summit last Monday, I spoke about my own program that I run to encourage more girls to join science, technology, engineering, and math. And without the help of my mentors and the support of from STEM programs such as FIRST that I've been involved in out of school time, and without the adult interaction and the time I have with them, I would not be able to speak with you today, and I would not have found my passion in STEM that I have now. At my presentation last Monday, I spoke about class sizes. My average class size is 38 students, and the class period is 90 minutes long. With this, meeting 45 times a semester and 2.3 minutes a day with my teacher, I get significantly less than 200 minutes over an entire semester with my teacher of one-on-one time. And I think that this really needs to change. In my calculus class, which is only offered one class for the entire high school, our class is over 40 students. And it's really tough to find to show kids how much math and science really means when the money and the money and the funding is not put there. With this, I fully support the our proposal for the from the STEM Task Force and the STEM Council, the STEM Hubs and programs, also the improvements to infrastructure and education. And thank you.
All right.
So we have a couple other task force members who are going to come up and share with you, and that'll be Eric Meslow, and from chairman of ETIC and also CEO of TimberCon, and also Terrell Smith, teacher from Sherwood High School.
And before they come up, Deb, I'm assuming Savannah's going to slip away and sit down. Before she left the dais, I wanted to see if there were any questions at all. Yes,
I'll just make a comment. So we did have Legos this weekend. Mm-hmm. We had three girls on our team, which, so to your point, out of 16 boys that my husband, or 16 kids that my husband was coaching, only three of them were girls. And immediately they got sniped up for next year by another Rosemont team who wants to have all-girl teams. And ironically, the winners were all-girl teams. They took home the big prizes this weekend. So, it's clear that we need to get more women into these fields. But 16 kids for one adult that was very difficult. And you're talking 30 from 38 is what you said in your class. That's just way too much to do what you really need to do, I think, to engage these kids hands-on. So that's my two bits.
All right. Thank you, Savannah. And if the others want to come up as there's room, Eric and others, as you were named off there, come right on up.
Chairs and committee members, we're hoping that we'll have time for questions at the end. So we think our presentation to time length that will permit that, but I'd say interrupt at any point with questions.
Co-chairs and members, my name is Terrell Smith. I am a full-time teacher at Sherwood High School. I teach computer science. And it's been an honor to be on this committee and to be a voice for professionals in the K-12 system. And I too have learned and have, I think there's been a lot of good two-way communication and understanding in this process. And I do believe that what we are presenting to you is result of good minds doing really good work. I want to address the issue of dual credit at the high school level. And the 40-40-20 plan does have that as a significant part. But just share with you my own experience as providing credit. Sherwood High School and many other high schools do offer dual credit for courses that align well with community college. Now, I would like to see that expanded to all STEM courses and maybe even beyond the community college level to the four-year colleges. And I think that's a high interest of this committee and of the plan. Some rationale for this, of course, it attracts students to the STEM programs when students know that they have a chance to get credit while they're taking a high school course. It provides a natural flow for students from the high school on into college. So that pushes that idea, creates a curriculum connection from the high school to the college. There's kind of a curriculum alignment, a natural curriculum alignment result. And of course, it fast tracks students into the workforce. And parents are always excited about it when they get to pay for 3 years of college instead of four. That happens. It happens often. I do have a couple stories somewhere in our system we've shared successes. One of them at Sherwood High School is an all girls engineering class, where we didn't know what the success would be, and it really was beyond our dream. Savannah has shared it at times what the concerns girls have about being in STEM related courses with guys, with boys, and so we thought we would pilot. We would hope to maybe get one class of 30 plus students, girls, and we ended up in the last year 140 girls that went through this program, and it was, you know, we really feel like it's a model for what can be done to increase some of the goals of the STEM Oregon STEM initiative. Another story a few years back, showing the idea of how cross-curricular STEM activities in a school can work. We had the language arts department teamed up with the engineering department to read and to build a drift boat. It's called a drift boat project, and they read about fly fishing in Montana. They designed a drift boat, and they wrote about their experience with designing the drift boat. They actually went in the engineering department and built a boat, and then wrote about that process in their creative writing class. And then finally, they put the boat in the water. They went fishing. And so these students went full circle from with the language arts department and the engineering department. And that's an idea of how STEM activities can go beyond the STEM curricular area. And that was a fun success. But right now, there's one that I'm involved in with computer science, where I have students who want to they want to design games that they're playing, and they have a high expectation for good games. Well, so we began to talk about it. Right now, we're immersed in a project where I'm bringing in, it happens to be mostly within the STEM curricular area, but they're building a computer game. They're going to 3D print their figurines. They designed them in 3D, in Rhino in 3D. They're building the room, their game room, and they're going to print that on a 3D printer. I had the kids that are working digital music in my class will be writing the background music for that, and they'll be doing technical writing in this whole process and presenting that at the game design contest in May at Chemeketa. And so those are just ideas of how these initiatives work and are successful, and our students they get up in the morning for this stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's the answer. What gets kids to school and keeps them coming back? And the Savannahs of the world, they are the end game. And that's why we as teachers are here, and why the STEM Task Force is here. It is just to bring that experience to students. Thank you.
Eric, go right ahead.
Co-Chair Gelser, Co-Chair Huffman, members of the committee, my name is Eric Meslow. I'm from Tualatin, Oregon. I'm the president of a company called TimberCon, which is also located in Tualatin. I'm here today representing a couple different hats, I guess. I am the current chair of ETIC, the Engineering Technology Industry Council, as well as I'm the co-chair with Jill Island from Intel of the STEM Employers Coalition, a group of about 40 to 50 large to small companies with a passion for this issue and an emphasis, who are going to place an emphasis on this issue in this next legislative session. Couple things. First of all, I promised myself after the leadership summit last week to never, ever follow Savannah on a dais. And I absolutely have another person I need to put on that list as well. So I'm going to just simply talk about a little bit about the needs of Oregon's employers. We are the consumers of the product that is being produced at all levels, K through 12, community college, and the four-year university system. And it is an ever-challenging system or situation to find the work-ready graduates at all levels, to fill the most mundane production level job to the highest research job. I have some numbers here, a little bit different than what Deb presented to you, but it tells the same kind of story, and I wanted to share them with you briefly. These are actually Oregon Employment Department numbers, so you can take them for what they're worth, but I tend to believe what they're talking about. It is projected over the next 10 years that Oregon will need about 39,000 to 40,000 new STEM positions within the state of Oregon. This does not include, this is a very tight definition of STEM, this does not include education, social science, or any of the healthcare occupations. So if you were to include any of those things, which sometimes are in STEM, the numbers would get even more dramatic. But these tend to be the traded sector type jobs, not the non-traded sector. Of those 40,000 jobs, about 24,000 of them are just to replace those people who are retiring. One of the things I do as chair and co-chair of my two groups is speak with employers. And in fact, I had lunch with a very large employer in Portland just this morning, and we talked about the very fact that average age of his engineering workforce, his machinists and everything else are in the 50s. And over the next 10 years, he's going to lose a huge percentage of his workforce. When you take that and lay it in over the numbers that we showed in regards to how many STEM-ready graduates the state of Oregon is producing, what you quickly find is Oregon is a parasitic state in regards to education. It's a harsh term, but I think it's a fair term in the sense that we rely on other states' education system to provide the STEM graduates that this state needs to produce and grow our economy. And I think that's just unconscionable. I think ultimately you have a situation where large employers like the Intels of the world can go anywhere in this world and get their graduates. A small company like myself under 100 employees can't. We need to hire Oregonians. And I would even argue that Intel wants to hire Oregonians first and foremost as well. Oregonians don't run after 3 years of dealing with our rain. They're used to it. They come, they stay, and you don't have to beg them to hang around. So ultimately, there are tremendous numbers of issues that we're dealing with. One of the things that I've come to conclude over my the last 8 years is that this is not an issue just of the four-year institutions, the university system, which is where I've spent most of my time working. But over working with the STEM Task Force, I want to emphasize strongly today that we cannot get to this, our goals, without emphasizing work within the community colleges. The fact of the matter is not every Oregonian is going to go on and get a four-year degree, but it is a fact in STEM that you need at least a professional certificate or a 2 years associate's degree to even be competitive on those starting jobs as laborers, as technicians, etc. So I want to emphasize that community colleges have not been involved to the same degree as other institutions, and it's time that we focus in that direction a little bit. I'll finish by using an Ericism, I guess. But it's going to be a new one, and I hope I don't embarrass her. But Savannah, on the very first day of the task force, said something only a young person would say amongst a group of folks that are significantly grayer than her. Is she said, "I really hope this task force isn't a waste of time." And those words are really strong, and I told her, and I think Representative Harker was in on the conversation, that we will do everything possible to make sure it wasn't a waste of time, that this isn't just about another group of people that get together and talk about a problem, but again, we try to solve this problem. So I do think you'll see some legislative concepts coming out shortly in regards to some strategies in funding the first steps in addressing the needs of this state when it comes to STEM education, and we'll look forward to being in front of this committee and others to talk in more detail when we get there.
Does that complete your panel?
That's yes, sir. That's all of us, Mr. Chairman.
I just wanted to ask Representative Dimbrough. I know he and Representative Johnson have done quite a bit of STEM work also as an outcropping of the Higher Ed Committee, and we had a 102 joint meetings in the Gorge. A lot of exciting things happening in the Gorge. Any thoughts or comments?
Well, just a couple. And I think some members of this group are coming to the Higher Ed Committee on Wednesday talking about the problem of students who are interested in STEM or STEM ready, and then they drop off as they're in college. And, you know, I hope we can have some conversations about why that's happening and what we can do to kind of incentivize people to stay in STEM. The meetings that we had out in the Gorge were very exciting, particularly because we saw such a strong sense of teamwork and partnership out there. And Eric was at one that I'm thinking of in was it in Hood River?
Yes.
I think, yeah. And that among the students, they were working in teams on STEM projects, and very often with very strong support from industry volunteers or supporters or whatever. And you know, it seems to me that there's a lot of leverage to be gained, and a lot more that we could be doing in that area. And I think that really was the genesis, that philosophy was the genesis behind the legislation that created this task force. And it sounds like that philosophy is continuing.
Representative Dimbrough, I would strengthen that by saying that there is a tremendous amount of fantastic work going on around the state, both in school and out of school, in regards to STEM education. What is ultimately lacking, however, is a coordination of those efforts, a funding of those efforts, and frankly, from my perspective, an attention to those issues. I always say at my office, unless you measure it, it generally isn't looked after. And we don't measure very well. We don't hold ourselves to a very high standard. We don't set STEM as a priority within our schools. To paraphrase Savannah again, when the athletic programs within her high school get dramatically more attention than the science programs within her high school, we're a little out of skew. And I'm not saying that we should defund athletics. I think that has a very important aspect to a child's development. But at the same time, where's the other piece? Where's the emphasis on academics? Where's the emphasis on STEM?
And I would like to say that before it slips my mind, I found out after we talked the other day, Savannah, that the Saturday before the leadership summit, the FLL robotics tournament, the head and shoulders winner was an all-girls team, one seventh grader, the rest were eighth graders from Hood River, and they did an amazing job. I mean, their score was like 352 or something, and the nearest was 220 to them. I mean, it was like blew them away. So that was encouraging also. Representative Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Rep. Dimbrough. First of all, I want to say how happy and fortunate I feel to have been on this task force and to have chaired it. To work with these people was really wonderful, and to have them give of their very, very busy lives, the amount of time that they did to bring their expertise to bear on this problem was fantastic, and I feel wonderful to have been part of that. One of the things, many things that I learned in this was details of the commitment of industry to help solve this problem, to help address the very significant gap that we have in this state between the jobs that are being offered and recruited for by employers of all different sizes, from little tiny companies like the one I used to own up to Intel and several others who were represented here. There is great passion out there. There is great commitment of time, money, on behalf of all of these different companies. And if we can tap into that, as I think we can, if we follow some of the recommendations of this task force and some of the upcoming legislation that we're putting in, I think we can really move the needle on this issue. And it's now up to us to follow through on that.
You know, it's awful easy to say, you know, Google or Intel or Gorge Tech Alliance members and whatnot, and I do appreciate them because, you know, Google and Gorge Tech Alliance members really have been, but a lot of their employees and other volunteers don't get paid for all the time they put in, so the volunteers have really, I know in my region, really helped to make it happen. Representative Frederick.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Chair. There are a couple things that come to mind for me. One is having been one of the science geeks for many years, and also watching the schools in Portland, in many cases, having no opportunity to do some of these things. Frankly, the kids not getting a chance to see that that's even possible. This is something I am real pleased to have you here and doing this, and I'm very curious about what you want to do, what's going to happen to you in the future, because the opportunities are really quite extraordinary. But as I look at many of the kids that I see on a regular basis, they don't even have that. They have no concept that these things even exist. Unfortunately, they have heard the phrase, if you value what you measure, and what people are measuring is how well they're doing on a multiple choice test, not how well they're doing on the innovation and the curiosity about science and technology. They see science and technology, or they see science as tests, as a boring, repetitive kind of endeavor, when it has an incredible amount of curiosity that's just the basis of it. We don't easily measure curiosity. And I would encourage you to try to find some way to make sure that we put that within the system, that we heard about earlier, that was specific to the way we grade schools, or the report cards for schools. That curiosity is important as far as I'm concerned. I am really pleased to see this effort going on, and with the A added, because that clearly puts part of it in there. But I really want to suggest that we need to understand that there is a lot more, that there's a lot more to this, to STEM, than just the details, the numbers. It is, in fact, opening up the ideas of what could happen in biology and physics and all of those fields. And we really haven't, and many of the kids that I see, are, by the time they reach middle school, are convinced that they simply cannot do science, because it is only memorization as far as they know.
Chair Huffman and Rep. Frederick, one of the other wonderful side benefits for me personally of being on this task force was meeting some of the people who are doing fantastic things along the lines of what you're seeking and rightly identifying as needs. We need to do a better job of capturing those people early on and fostering their interest through middle school so that they don't drop out. But we also need to identify those kids for whom this type of endeavor is not on their radar and get it on their radar. And we had one of the outings that we had as part of the task force was a field trip to Franklin High School, which is doing truly amazing work at identifying kids from all different socioeconomic strata and demonstrating to them that they can master not just the STEM disciplines, although those certainly were included, but to aim high academically and to see that college or community college is on their path if they just take the first steps and have supportive teachers and industry partners who will encourage them and goad them at times as needed, that they can make really big strides in their lives and change their lives for the better in this regard.
Representative Frederick, one of the most important things that an employer can do is really provide our time and our experiences more than even our checkbooks. Now, checkbooks are important, and I appreciate that. But, again, at this lunch I had today, we were talking to an employer who has a very specific program of reaching out to the local schools in the high school level, bringing in students on work internships, paid internships in high school that expose them to all levels of opportunity within STEM within their organization, from basic machining all the way to the engineering side and design side of things, allowing those students to really kind of select a path that they might be interested in pursuing, and ultimately then having those students stay with them for 3 or 4 years as they go into community college or into a four-year school where they're expected to come back during the summers and work for that company. The benefit for the company is twofold. Number one, they're doing their corporate duty as a good citizen, but most importantly, they're getting to test drive some great new employees and, frankly, invest at the right time in a child's education and ultimately end up with employees that may last for forever. So those types of opportunities are what employers can do, and many employers do, but ultimately it's the employers that have the time, the resources, and the size to be able to do those things. What I would like to see the state of Oregon do, as an example, is help facilitate that with other size organizations. And one of the ways you can do that is incentivize the educational system to reach out as opposed to employers having to reach in. And there's a lot of different ways through competitive RFP process and others that you can write great grant proposals that measure exactly what kind of outputs you want, and if that is getting internships and work experiences and getting kids exposed to those opportunities early enough that they may choose that math is worth it, because if I do take enough math, I can be a machinist, or if I even take more math, I might be able to become a mechanical engineer, or if I actually pay attention in chemistry class, biology class, I could go on and to one of the health fields. And I think that's what's so important, and what I think the business community can easily do if, again, rallied and coordinated from some standpoint.
Co-Chair Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation and all of your work the last year on this project. And Savannah, thanks for coming today. I wanted to follow on what Representative Frederick talked about. He talked about the importance of creativity and kids still being engaged in the process and the learning and exploration process when they get to middle and high school. I want to ask you if you looked at the issue of a pipeline of kids that can do the math and science to be able to explore their creativity. If we have kids who are struggling in kindergarten, in third grade, in fifth grade, with class sizes that are as large or larger as what Savannah described, and we have kids that are coming in with learning challenges, how do we help them meet that level of math and science education and proficiency to be able to engage in these opportunities? And I would use an example from my own school district. I attended a school board meeting where the Corvallis High School principal, Matt Boring, did a project. He wanted to go and look at why every kid that had a failing grade in the ninth grade failed. What had they failed? And the vast majority of those Fs were in algebra. And what was interesting about those kids that failed algebra, the year before in the eighth grade, they had failed pre-algebra. But the high school can't afford to offer anything less than algebra and still provide a credit to the kids. So if they don't provide that credit, those kids are going to risk not meeting the standards that they need to graduate from high school. His question was, how do we meet this need with the resources we have to actually teach these kids the foundations of math so we're not setting them up to fail in algebra? So I would argue we talk a lot about an achievement gap. I think this is an opportunity gap. How do we fill that opportunity gap, give greater opportunities to kids so that they can succeed in third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, seventh grade, so they can go out for for a robotics team so that they can do the kinds of exciting things that Savannah is going to be able to do? And how do we do that for the most challenged learners in our districts with the resources that we have today?
Is that a question or it's more of a statement, wasn't
it? It's a statement, but I'm wondering if you talked about that issue, that pipeline issue. If they're going to stay engaged, how do we get them prepared to be engaged by the time they're middle schoolers? They're still kids.
Co-Chair Gelser, Terrell Smith, Sherwood High School. I don't have an answer. The risk of balancing high standards in math results in sometimes in what you had just described. We've been pushing the math requirement down year by year, and now what do we do with the kids that struggle? There hasn't been the time, face-to-face time maybe, to pay close attention to them because of large class sizes, and that is a problem. The answer is, you know, is lower class sizes and more remedial time for them to be able to catch them up. But Matt Mooring, and I'll have to give him, he was my vice principal a couple of years ago, so I'll have to say that we circled back with him. But we looked at that same thing at Sherwood High School. What was the reason? And so maybe he brought that there. But future success depends upon current success. So as we look at what that transition is, if we identify that, if we have the time and resources to identify it, I think we can solve it. But the task force is suggesting is that we provide extra opportunities for those students. And let's look at it from an incentive point. Students who need a robot to pick up a ball and drop it in a can have a reason to learn math. I'm just not sure that our culture has set a clear reason to learn math yet. And when we look at those robotic contests and the excitement, and you know, kids have, when they get involved in a robot team at the high school, then they come to me and says, "Yeah, I need to know programming language. T. Smith, can you teach me C++? Because that's the language." And so the kids, I think the out of school programs that we talked a lot about is an answer. It's not the answer, but there's a lot. There's going to have to be a lot of an answers, and the out of school opportunities in STEM is an answer.
Well, and just briefly, on behalf of my community, I'd like to say thank you to Sherwood for sending us Matt Boring and Eric Beasley and Aaron Prince.
We'll pass for another day.
Eric Beasley, as in David Beasley's son?
Yes, he is our middle school principal, and we took their...
Another life, but tell Eric I said hi.
To be our superintendent as well. We're coach from Sherwood.
JJ and Justin and Ben's dad. He'll know. Representative Kopp.
Thank you. Co-Chair Huffman, I wish I had an easy question. I don't. And I have two. And before I ask my questions, I want to preface that you'll never, I'm as big a supporter of STEM and STEAM as you're going to find. But as a previous educator, I'll have a question for Terrell in just a moment. And don't steal Terrell from Sherwood.
No more poaching.
Yeah, he's just done an incredible job in so many facets there. I want to make one comment and then I'll have my questions. The reality in Oregon is that some students aren't burnt out on science by the time they get to middle school. The reality in a lot of school districts in Oregon, the curriculum of science is not even taught in elementary school.
Right, it's true. Right.
That's reality. And that's who my heart really hurts for. Because the science, the fun, the exploration that Representative Frederick talked about isn't even mentioned. And I'm appalled. I'm appalled as an educator, I'm appalled as a legislator, that there is so much emphasis on reading and math tests that our children are losing a huge opportunity to be excited about learning and what makes this world revolve. It is science that keeps our planet system in place. It keeps our moon in the sky and our sun pulling us and keeping us warm. That's a tragedy. That we're even at this point where we can talk about it today a little bit helps my heart a little bit. But I'm more of a math geek than I am a science geek, and so my question is one for Terrell and then one for Representative
Parker.
Thank you. How can we do? What's the logistics around that Sherwood is learning about when we do the STEM classes? And then we have IB classes, we have AP classes, and you talked about dual credit. And so systemically, do they blend together, or are they in separate silos?
Representative Comp, Terrell Smith, Sherwood High School. We have been more of a silo system recently because of lack of funding, large class size, and the energy has been drawn out of the system. I've been teaching in Sherwood for 34 years. And to address your issue, while I taught science many years ago, while elementary science, there was a full curriculum, and I was involved in district-level curriculum science, K-12, and alignment thereof. And so hopefully we would receive those students with a good background at the high school level. Talking with my elementary colleagues these days, just to confirm your disappointment in our system, is that we are not delivering that discovery science. And so it has come to, Representative Frederick indicated that it's testing. It's, so there's some challenges here and some results of good intentions but unintended results. And science may, certainly at that elementary level may be a concern there. But what about AP courses? There's a lot of interest at the high school level. AP, IB, focused in arts. Where do we get our students? And the idea that the funding for offering a broad array of classes may not be there. Then what? It's a tough situation. A district has to decide. And this is where one of the recommendations out of the draft is STEM-themed buildings and or districts, mm-hmm. where that draws attention from the community and industry into maybe human capital that helps keep that focus sustained, maybe external funding as these hubs will do. So I have been in the business 34 years and I have fewer answers today about some of these things than I did years ago when funding was a little more adequate. I would say, let's create a class. Yeah. Let's create a department. But it's a little more difficult now. However, we can create demand with these after-school programs addressing the students. The underrepresented students really thrive in these after-school programs. And when they thrive, they ask for courses. When students ask for courses, the money, you put together 35 excited kids to do some form of computer science and or engineering, then the district says, well, yeah, we have to serve the students somewhere. But again, Ericism is we focus on what we test, and that has been a challenge in some areas.
And I will just, because I know our time's short, I will make this a rhetorical statement rather than a question. And that is, I know Mr. Cannon is here to talk to us a little bit, and we are hearing from the OEIB board about tight, loose fitting. Mm-hmm. And what I would want us to consider when we're talking about hubs, the first thing when Representative Harker, when you were talking, it came to mind, it's like, okay, we've been talking about less boards and less government. So I think you're going to be an example for all of us to say, okay, how does this fit in? How do we make it work? And Eric has given us an exceptional examples of how it can work, and I just want to thank you all for your work. And that's all, folks.
Thank you. And our next panel is here, but Representative Parrish.
Okay, so on the legislative recommendations, are we going to see those come into bill form, the STEM Council? I'm assuming the work of your task force is going to, hopefully then some of those players will stay on and be on that council. And I say that, and I'm interested in seeing that, and I would support that, because I'm going to go back to the graph from the class of 2006, and I guess I'm really, this tells us something, but it doesn't tell us enough. Like, I'd be curious to see the council eventually go back further than the 10th grade and really try to figure out where the break in opportunity happened for those kids and the why behind it, because it's disturbing enough that almost 4,000 kids who from 10th grade to high school didn't graduate, the drop of almost 20,000 who somehow fell out of the college higher ed path loop, you know, and then only a third of those kids roughly got any kind of degree. I mean, just the decline in that number, something further back than 10th grade will tell us some of that story, and I really hope that the STEM Council, that we pass that and get that going, would take this chart back and go do something more with it, because the data here, you know, it's, as a middle school mother, it's very disheartening to see that that's the trajectory my kid could be on, and so, you know, just based on the numbers, statistically, so can you just, is that the role?
Can you just agree and say yes? I'll be happy to do that, Rep. Parrish.
What he said. Yes, yes. Disheartening, disturbing are very appropriate adjectives, and no, we did not stop at the report. We have legislation that is being introduced, and I can stop right there. I'm not, it looks like maybe Eric.
I think Representative Parrish, I just want to let you know, be assured that there's a lot more numbers, and we'll be more than happy to share them with you. We've done, Eco Northwest took a really deep plunge on this, and we can bury you.
That's awesome, and I hate to cut it short,
oh,
because
you're
spot on. Yep. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a reason why kids aren't graduating, kids aren't getting involved, and identifying that and correcting the problems where why we're here should be. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the
all of you.
Public meeting on the STEM update, and I'm going to open a public informational meeting on the presentation of the Governor's 2013 Education Agenda. Ben, I'm going to call you up if you want Matt and Dr. Crew to come at the same time, or how I'll let you direct it. And welcome.
Okay, wonderful. Thanks, Eric. Appreciate it. Yeah.
Sorry for the rush, but...
No, we're very grateful for the time. Thank you.
It's going to cost you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, former colleagues. Thank you for putting time aside on your agenda today for us to begin to work with you on some priorities that I think we share. We're going to spend, really the gentlemen on my side are going to spend some time here discussing what will be the governor's two major priorities for the 2013 legislative session. And let me just express on his part a real desire and hope to deepen our engagement with you around the development of these pieces of work, which you'll hear today are really in the process of being developed and not a done deal. We haven't put a legislative concept smack down in front of you, so you're going to hear about work in process, and in whatever constellation of committees you're organized for the 2013 session, we'll work with you on bringing them forward. So if you think about the OEIB and the reason for its creation, the governor's support, and the support of this legislature for the OEIB, it really had two major buckets of work. One related to building out a P20, an integrated, coordinated P20 system from birth through career. And the second bucket was to bring forward recommendations for how to use the state's power as an investor in public education to improve outcomes. And those two buckets of work have guided the OEIB over the last year, and they're reflected in the what you'll hear from Dr. Crew and from Matt Donegan. So we'll go in reverse order. We'll start with that second bucket, and Dr. Crew describing the way in which the budget has brought forward recommendations for strategic investment in order to leverage outcomes. And then Matt Donegan, an OEIB board member, will describe the ongoing, evolving thinking around how to better coordinate this P20 system in order to achieve these achieve the outcomes. So I think with that, turn it over to Rudy.
Thank you very much, and thank you to all. I would like to start by just simply identifying what essentially are the sort of core elements of the strategic initiatives that Ben just referred to.
And Dr. Crew, I want to make sure that the millions of people watching via the camera know exactly who you are. So if you could identify yourself.
I'm sorry. I'm Rudy Crew, and I'm Chief Education Officer.
Thank you.
My apologies. What I was saying was that I would go through and at least list them out and then go through them again with an eye toward giving more a little bit more detail as to what we mean by them. The first of them, apropos of the prior conversation, is specifically about STEM. It's an investment, a strategic investment, in the notion that there needs to be both greater content, greater support for the development of initiatives, some of which are already happening in the state, but ultimately coalescing those initiatives and building an entire platform in which better instruction, deeper instruction in math and science is available. Secondly, there are opportunities available for historically underrepresented groups, including young girls going through and taking part in higher levels of math and science as it relates to STEM and STEM careers. That there are additional specific trainings, if you will, and opportunities for students in a 6 through 14 continuum, recognizing that there are some pretty significant numbers of students not only who are not graduating, but frankly who are not even getting the necessary coursework that they need as a way of being able to think, theoretically at least, about going into a career in the STEM field or in anything that even remotely relates to STEM, whether it's computer science or anything else. And that this would work in the context of a set of structures. We are thinking about those structures being related ultimately to a sort of a hub of sorts. I know it's maybe a much overused word right now, but a way of being able to think about this as being statewide. So it's not necessarily just a new program or a new initiative, but really it ends up being a center that is in virtually every sector or segment of the entire state, and it focuses on this 6 through 14 continuum. It has a relationship with business. It has an ongoing and continued relationship with career and technical programs, and it ultimately scales up so that students are able to participate not only in a school-related activity, but ultimately in a world-to-work activity as well, connected to their potential career and career choices. The second area is reading, or literacy as we refer to it sometimes. It really is about several specific bodies of work that we're trying to pull together. One is being able to identify at a very, very early age what the specific parent engagement work looks like and should be about in helping people to come to school ready to learn. And that means that they have pre-literacy skills. That means that they have decoding skills. It means that they actually have a way of being able to think about reading, if you will, as something that's fun and enjoyable, and they have some at least initial skills of being able to do that. We think that this whole question of reading has to have a major focus on children whose first language is not English, recognizing again that the home is the center of this, or the epicenter really of this from its very inception, but that what happens in the home ultimately gets strengthened and fortified by their early experiences from really zero to grade three. And that we have, as a result of that, greater numbers of students who are proficient readers by grade three. Those numbers right now, in my mind, are somewhat tragic. This is going to include every student. This would involve children whose first language is not English. It would involve special needs children. It would involve children who have any kind of need for greater support in how they acquire language. And the multitude of tools that teachers have, which is maybe the third area that I'll quickly bridge to, the multitude of skills that teachers have and tools that they have in being able to provide this kind of structured reading program is going to be done through what we think of as this agenda, if you will, on professional development and the development of a core of well-trained professional educators. This is a strategy that, as an investment, really recognizes the need for us to pay great attention to the content, if you will, by which teachers are trained, the structure and strategies by which people are onboarding into the profession of teaching, the need for us as a state to pay greater attention to developing a core of well-trained, high-quality teachers, who, many of whom would be of color, many of whom whose first language itself was perhaps not English, and who in fact have cultural identification with the students who are growing in number in our schools. It would also involve looking at and rethinking the way ESDs function as to how this training and service might be provided for teachers. That much of this is both on the ground, if you will, but it also is a collaboration between and among multiple sets of training institutions, one of which would be ESDs, but the other which other of which would be our colleges of education. And so this particular strategic investment envisions being able to bring a set of collaborative partners together to look at and build a structure, perhaps somewhat new, and in some cases things that we've already been doing in the state, but to build a structure in which we recruit, train, and then support teachers through a system that is available, again, throughout the entire state. So we see being able to use multiple institutions, multiple colleges of education, clearly ESDs and the like, as a way of being able to build that new structure. And the last, and certainly not least, of these initiatives really is about creating an opportunity for counseling and support for post-secondary and career aspirations that we ultimately see as many young people are going through the P20 system, and we heard from them as we went out to the various forums throughout the state that what they're really interested in is the need for some kind of ongoing support as it relates to thinking about college, being able to pay for college, being able to access college because it really is something that is affordable to them, or they see additional dollars through the opportunity grants and so forth as a way by which to both go and or complete a post-secondary institution. But critically, it's about how that guidance function happens in relation to their ability to think about their career and technical aspirations, and anything that they see as needing to have a counselor for, or a counselor-like kind of role in their quest for the completion of higher education. So those four things really represent the bodies of work. I'm happy to speak to them in any greater detail at your pleasure.
Thank you. And Matt, you're fine. I got the gavel, so you're not getting in trouble for anything. It's all good.
Okay.
Any questions up to this point for Ben or Dr. Crew?
Well, Dr. Crew, I actually had several questions, but just to throw one out, professional development of teachers. And I know you just kind of skimmed across the surface and talked at the very high conceptual level, but you mentioned recruiting, training, and supporting teachers. I just would like to hear a little bit more about that, and the reason I'm asking the question is I've spent some time getting to know some teachers in my district and spent some time in classrooms there. And my perception is that most of the teachers who are there are actually very good at what they do. I just spent some time with three fifth grade classes. All three of the teachers were incredibly impressive. They were teaching civics. I could go on and on about that. But my impression is that they're very good, and the problems that they're having, if any, certainly at that level, relate more to class sizes and the loss of younger teachers through attrition as the number of teachers has been reduced over the last couple of years. So could you maybe, I guess my question is it really the problem that we're not recruiting them, we're not training them, and we're not supporting them once they're in the career, or is the problem some other issue with the system where we're just losing good teachers?
Well, my response would be that I think it's a both and. I don't think it's an either or. I think we are not anything or any place different from what the data looks like around the rest of the country, where even in the best of fiscal years, even when class sizes were lower and when the dollars were frankly a little bit more fluid than they are in today's market, we found that the nation was, first of all, not being able to recruit enough teachers into the field. B, that those that did come stayed an average of about 3 years and then left. And then three were more than likely going to leave the profession, not because they didn't have adequate dollars or even because of class size. They were leaving because they effectively were not given ongoing development and support as they went through their career. And when you ask the teachers, and this is, you know, there's a fair amount of research about this, when you ask teachers what they really want, what they want is they want to have, they don't want to work in isolation. They want their ideas to be functionally heard and responded to in a more, if you will, creative environment. They want to be able to find new and different ways, new and different strategies of working with young people. I think we've been slightly leaning much more as a country toward, you know, heavy, heavy, heavy dose of testing, and that becomes, as they see it, what their primary role is going to be. And so when you look at who's exiting, they're exiting for a whole host of reasons, but the data are pretty clear that a good deal of it is they didn't feel supported in the system. The system left them in isolation, and they actually did their work for the most part in isolation, and that they ultimately ended up leaving, you know, in great numbers at the end of about 2.5 or 3 years. Our response to this is, listen, at least in this biennium, let's get it right on the training and recruitment and support piece. Let's make sure that we have places where no teacher goes a year, 180 days, or whatever the number of days they have in a year, where they do not feel an adequate level of support. Let's make sure that we are recruiting people into the field who view this as a long-term commitment and whom they have a real likelihood that the state will be making a long-term investment in them. And by doing that, using our community colleges, our universities, colleges of education, ESDs, et cetera, that a person can look at their length of time in service here and see that there's a structure designed to help them and support them as they go through their career. That is notwithstanding the issue of class size, which you raised, and I think you're absolutely right about. We need to ultimately reduce these class sizes. They are incredibly high and unforgivably a good deal of the reason and that people fundamentally see this as an unwinnable charge. And so they ultimately, in many cases, do simply suggest, listen, this is just not doable. I can't win even if I'm the very best at what I do. I can't get it right because I've just got too many kids in the classroom. And I think that those two things are going to have to be taken in concert. I don't think that one is looming higher in priority than the other. I think that, as you'll see from the governor's budget, there's an attempt to at least put an installment or a first installment on the reduction of class size statewide. But again, our primary focus through this initiative was let's get more and more and more people into the profession who view this as a long-term profession and see it as a way by which to be supportive and helpful for the young people that they have in front of them, and that they've got real data, real research, real new strategies, up to date, up to current technology and other resources available for them to use in the process.
Did you have additional?
May just follow up briefly on that. That I think that makes a lot of sense. And I know you referenced data that I haven't seen, so I don't know where it came from. But I wonder, have you gone and asked teachers who have been in the career for a long time what things kept them there, what things have changed, what would they say was important for teachers starting their careers? And when you say recruiting and training, for example, I perceive, and this may not be true, but I perceive education as being, when you talk about training, a lot of that, I think, takes place in the classroom environment and interaction with other teachers in the form of mentoring, which is a lot like other professions,
right.
Law being one.
Right.
So, I mean, is that consistent with what you're talking about?
Yes, that's okay. Very consistent with it. It's hosting the conversations that a new teacher might need to have with a mentor teacher around how do I meet or reach a certain group of students? How do I get better leverage at working with certain profiles of youngsters who are now coming into my school that I'm not used to having worked with in the past? It's having a critical, if not analytical, partner with whom to actually share the journey through the profession. And we need to actually build structure for that. But in answer to the first part of your question, Representative Conger, I have asked teachers. I have sat in some of the same classrooms, perhaps, as you, and I've done it now in Oregon quite a bit all over the state. And the answer to the question is a multitude of things, but what it comes down to is I unfortunately feel like I am in isolation, and my isolation is causing me to miss the mark, and this is a mark that is now made more public more and more and more across the country by virtue of the way accountability structures are being built, and I don't want to look very badly in my professional work. That's part of it. Second is, I don't have the strategies for being able to work with every single kid I have. I can get a third of them, or maybe even two-thirds of them. But there's a third of them that I'm missing the mark for, And when I miss the mark, that third occupies a very low rung, if you will, on the developmental ladder because they left my class incomplete. They left my class without the requisite skills to move sometimes to the next level. Now, some of our alternative programs and some other programs are picking up some of these youngsters, but sadly, too many of them don't make it out. You saw from the most recent dropout report that many of them don't make it out of high school, and it's not because they don't have the gray matter to do it. It's because we didn't find the right strategy by which to tantalize and really engage and find the joy within these youngsters and what they ultimately really love about learning. And we didn't turn them on. We didn't get it done. Teachers take real responsibility for this. I've never met one that didn't. They take real responsibility for this, but they want to have a better than 60% chance of getting it right. And so that's the basis upon which we're talking about really helping people who are in the profession stay in the profession, because there are trainings, there are real strategy building opportunities. We're talking about an extended platform here of more time with young people around this whole issue of literacy. The question becomes, what would a teacher do differently if they had even more time? Right? Many of them will tell you, well, I tried to do what I did that I didn't get done during the course of the day. Well, the question is really about, well, what would you do differently? Right? And so to a large extent, what I view as being really important for this conversation to be helpful to teachers is the reduction of their isolation, really focusing on supporting what they need in the way of whether it's technology or just building new and different ways of working with young people, or even just understanding how the human brain has changed over the years and figuring out new and different strategies for them being able to be successful in their classroom.
Co-Chair Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all for coming to give this presentation today. Can you tell me a little bit more about what specific policy proposals we'll be seeing, if there are legislative concepts that are coming and when we might see them? And further, could you talk a little bit more specifically about the proposals related to education service districts and what, in your view, if we were to implement the budget priorities and any legislative proposals that are coming forward, what would Oregon ESDs look like and what would they be doing on January 1st of 2015?
Can I just jump in and then turn it over to you? You will be hearing from Rob Saxton, I think, later on in today's meeting. And at the request of the governor, Rudy, Rob has put together a work group to address the ESD question in particular. So I would encourage you, I mean, Rudy, I'm sure, has some thoughts there as well, but Rob is really sort of principally leading that up. In terms of policies, bills, and timing. Here's where we are. We have a budget, obviously, that the governor has presented that includes some dedicated funding for the four strategic initiatives that Rudy described. We are in the process of developing a governance proposal that you'll see the kind of framework for from Matt, and that will require additional fleshing out. That will come in the form of an amendment to a placeholder bill that the governor has. And then the whatever policy changes are required as a result of the budget and the strategic investments and some of the ways that the board and Rudy described spending it, we'll be working on as a bill or amendment to a placeholder bill between now and the start of the session. It isn't clear to us precisely yet what those policy changes would be. I hope they're fewer rather than more. A lot of what Rudy's describing builds on existing initiatives that this legislature and school districts have started around the state. But there may be places where what the board and Rudy want to do with these initiatives would require statutory change. So we're in the process of evaluating that.
Thank you, and I appreciate the complicated process of all of the boards and organizations. I just know that as I'm around the state visiting with superintendents and school board members and parents and others who are interested specifically in the K-12 system, it seems the legislative session is coming quickly. And what's different this session from others is that I don't know what to tell them, because I really don't have a sense of what it is that's going to be proposed by the executive branch. So I'm wondering, is there a time in the near future where legislators might be part of the conversation leading up to the session to be able to see kind of in writing on paper, this is what the professional development centers look like, or this is what it looks like in policy, this early childhood parental engagement. I think the broad strokes are there, but the legislative session is short, time is short, and I'm wondering when legislators get an opportunity to see the specifics so that we can partner with you in fully vetting these ideas and hopefully possibly moving some of them through the legislative process this session.
I would say that we'll have a pretty good handle on the level of policy discourse that we're going to want to both bring to the legislature and through the board, probably in the February time frame, February March time frame. And I can answer your question this way too, Representative Gelser. I think that you're going to, I think it's fair to say that the areas where there are real policy possibilities, the ESDs being one, right, and by that I mean there's money that actually has to now go to the creation of some of these kind of development centers that we're talking about, but what that means from a standpoint of policy, who would get what services, how those services would be distributed, et cetera, different conversation, and may have some policy implications. The second one is the whole issue of ELL. Again, it could very well be this is just a state board conversation, but it is one that I know we are going to be looking at with respect to the whole question of what are the real policy requirements for creating an educational setting in which we double down, if you will, on really students who are not, whose language is not English, but also students who are doing extraordinarily well and who need just some additional support for them to extend their learning. You know, so what are the rules of engagement around new and different platforms that you hear me talking about? More time in the day, more time in the year. There's not everything is going to necessarily, hopefully, have to go to policy, but it is a way of being able to give you an idea of some of the things that may, in fact, generate some of that. The whole issue of STEM, you know, and what that looks like from the standpoint of collaboration with business, collaboration with higher education, collaboration with a whole host of other agencies, again, may have some real policy implications. And the last, and certainly not least one, is the one that Representative Conger and I were just talking about, which is this whole issue of teacher preparation. I can think of a number of policy questions that are embedded in this whole issue of, you know, not just who teaches, but how do we prepare them in a way that allows for them to really, you know, get greater, more and more people invested in teaching as a profession throughout this entire state, and what might that look like at a policy level as it relates to other disciplines, people who are in other walks of life, people who are not traditional, quote-unquote, teachers or come from pedagogical schools, such as schools of education. Are there ways by which to actually enlist others in the mentoring work, in the guidance work, and so on and so forth? So, again, these are areas that I'm giving you in broad brush. I realize it's not maybe at the level of detail that you would prefer, but at least it gives you a kind of a ballpark of what kinds of things we're thinking about.
And I guess just as one further follow-up, my concern at this point is much less about the content and more about the process. And I think, again, what I've heard, and I don't know about other members if they've heard this as well, from school boards and superintendents and ESDs and parents and education advocates, is that there's been a lot of change over the last couple of years and not a lot of opportunity for engagement in that process. And I worry a little bit about how we get that needed buy-in for transformational change in Oregon education if we don't have bills ready until March. Our chamber deadline is in April, and typically by the time we get to March, we've had big hearings on things, we've started to do amendments so that we can move them through. I think it will be very difficult to move things with adequate public process where people really have the opportunity to come, understand what's being proposed, and engage in it if it's delayed to that level. And I think it's really important going forward that we have a robust public process with hearings where people are able to come, where school districts have time to provide feedback about how these things are really going to work for them. So the sooner that specificity can come in the form of legislative concepts, I think it would be very helpful, and I think would help to get some more buy-in across the state for change. And I think the role of the legislature in this process is to facilitate that and to make sure that it is a very robust process that gives all of those stakeholders a fair shot to come and provide their feedback and adjustments and recommendations.
I am so advised, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gelser. And we've had discussions on this offline as I came in mid-year, and we've worked to give direction to the Education Committee. And Ben and I have had the conversation that we want not only the Education Committee but the legislature to be an early participant in the work. You know, there was a lot of fanfare. I'm not going to attribute this to you. I'll take credit for this. There was a lot of fanfare, and rightfully so, of bills that we passed at the very end of the 2011 session. But I've also been very upfront about saying that is not a process that I want to be involved in again. It did not allow the proper public vetting, and I would not be a fan of going there again. Representative Demereaux.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, great to see you. And I'd like to pick up on a couple of the points that my colleagues have made. You know, they're related, and initially, at least, they're related to the new centers of whatever they're called, student learning, student excellence, which student achievement centers, which, you know, it seems to me still, you know, following up on Representative Gelser's point, still needs some fleshing out, you know, as far as what exactly those will involve. The budget talks about them costing $120 million, and that money coming from the ESDs. $120 million is a lot of money. Let me say, first of all, you know, I'm very supportive of professional development, and especially I really appreciate the points you made, Dr. Crewe, about creating incentives for teachers to work together in teams and partnerships, et cetera. It's very, very important. But again, $120 million is a lot of money, and that will presumably come out of the ESD budgets. And what will we lose from the ESDs by that money being taken out of the ESDs? I mean, I think that's a question I think we need to know. And then I have a follow-up, so why don't you just do that, please?
Well, I think it's a bit premature for me to try to answer it in full because they haven't even met yet to really talk about what the design would be. But I, just judging from what I have seen, there are some districts that have argued that what they would lose is their pass-through money, that the money that came to them from the ESD was money that essentially came for specific services on some sort of a formula or per capita basis, that money would then, out of this 120, would absorb that, and therefore they would lose some of that pass-through money that they used to get. Portland gets X. I can't remember what Seattle gets, but they've indicated that there's a loss there for them. In other cases, service-wise, I don't think that there is a particular set of services that we are interested in seeing lost, because we know that there are small districts who desperately need to have the ESD as a really cost-effective way of being able to deliver and distribute services in ways that they wouldn't have been able to do any other. They wouldn't be able to find or do, particularly around special education and so forth, any other way. So to the point of what is lost, I think that this is actually, there's a funding base, and there's some potential tax dollars that accrue to the ESDs that are potentially the source of much concern, and I'm not sure where that would go, but depending upon where they how they meet this out. But I don't know any other services and so forth, right, that they would lose.
Thank you. But I mean, just to clarify, at some point we're going to have to decide that we want to spend these dollars here and not here. And so, you know, it's going to have to become clear to us that we would rather invest the money in this place, you know, in the student achievement centers, rather than, you know, XYZ up to 100 or whatever services are being provided there that we're willing to give up or do in another way. So, and, you know, I don't, you know, I'm not expecting you to be prepared to answer that today, but at some point, you know, certainly by the beginning of the session, right, we're going to have a pretty clear sense of that.
Right. Agreed. Yeah. Thank you.
My other question is about the response to intervention network, which is referenced here. To my mind, one of the the best things about the achievement compacts, at least in concept, is that they will help us to identify schools or districts that need help, and then resources can then go to those districts in a kind of rapid intervention manner. And so, if I understand correctly what the rapid intervention network funds are for, that's what they're for. That's sort of the state side of that two-way compact. You know, schools, you do this, you get this, you need this, you get this. So I guess my question is how much will be available in those funds? Because I hope that it's substantial enough so that we really can help those districts that need to, for example, have a summer program to get those eighth graders who are not doing well in pre-algebra to be able to do algebra. And I don't mean just simply summer school, but something more creative and something that will really engage them. To do that all around the state in order to close what Representative Gelzer called the opportunity gap. So I wonder if you could say something
about that. Well, you're spot on in terms of the intended outcome here. This is, as you just described it, that is exactly how we envision it. That this is about a strategic investment in areas where a district sees itself in need of additional resources as a way of being able to intervene in some of its patterns of low performance. Now, I have argued for a long time that dollars represent one way of being able to be responsive to that, but not the only way. That some of these opportunities are a function of what a P20 system gives you, which is the opportunity to knock on the door of that community college or knock on the door of the early learning environment and begin to say, let's try to figure out from a higher ed standpoint or from a early learning standpoint how this collaboration might result in a more effective delivery of something else other than just money. Now, money obviously is a way of being able to prime that pump, but it isn't the only thing. So this is about money that begets innovation and entrepreneurship. This is about opportunities to leverage money so that we actually can bring more and more resources to some of these hot spots. And then, as those areas begin to diminish, as we begin to see that there are fewer, third graders who are not proficient, then those dollars can be moved to other areas. Right. Once the system gets to be to the point where it's somewhat more predictable and right and right-sized, then I think you can begin to move those monies and it becomes a much more efficient process. So I think this is about the dollars leveraging more opportunity initially, but also giving rise to greater creativity among and between partners, both in higher education and early learning, frankly, community-based organizations that will successfully intervene in the patterns of low performance. There are 90 priority and focus schools. A state this size, I would argue, is probably that's way, way, way out of line. There are many other schools that have a growing number of children with special needs, many of whom need additional resources, others of whom actually is a statement. The statement of those students being identified is that they just don't know what else to do. So they're placing them where the public law was never really intended for them. So it's really about providing services in a way that really begins to tailor and focus on exactly what needs we have, where those needs are, and then ask people to innovate and change and create new levers using the P20 system to help them to do that.
Okay, thank you. And then just to kind of pin you down one last time, so the amount of money that's projected to be in this fund that can be used for response to intervention, so how much is that being increased in the budget? Do we know?
I don't know the answer to that.
I mean, we're undertaking this new initiative of supporting districts and thinking of the Department of Ed as, you know, supporting districts. And so the question is, you know, where is the investment in that, I guess?
Where is the investment?
I mean, in creating this, you know, the fund to be able to, you know, support the districts that are in need.
Right. Well, the $120 million that you referenced earlier represents the bedrock of the funding, discretionary funding, to be able to invest in how schools and districts would have additional resources
for professional development.
Well, that's for professional development, but then that relieves other dollars that they have to be able to use for their own discretion or at their own discretion. There are any number of additional dollars through literacy work, through the reading program and reading work that we're talking about, that really asks districts to extend their day and extend their year in ways that might make some sense for certain populations of youngsters. We think that there are going to be any number of dollars around STEM, not necessarily just state dollars, but ultimately dollars that we would leverage from the outside. I've already been back to Washington, D.C. to see whether or not there are additional matching dollars. So I think that this is an investment budget, that, if you will, that calls other people into the fray and says, let's try to leverage these dollars, small as they may be right now. You know, the reading dollars are $11 million. The counseling support for post-secondary, that's $12.5 million, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, these aren't huge numbers to begin with, but they're numbers that actually get people off the dime in creating just the program that they didn't have before that might speak to a certain population of youngster for whom schooling was in that sort of lower quadrant, and they were going to be in the next, you know, USA report on high school dropouts from the state of Oregon. I mean, this has got to be something we take a bite out of.
Thank you. Matt, I don't know how much time you needed, if we can call it 10 to 15 minutes, and I want to give Rob 10 to 15 minutes. Will that be sufficient? And I know there's a reception at 4.
Correct.
If members, which I was going to go to also, but if members could stay till 4:05, would that be okay? 4:03 and a half? Okay. Going once. So, Matt, you're up. Thank you.
Okay. All right, we're going to advance to... Still going, right? This is the just half of it. You want both halves? Yeah. Look at how much time we're cutting down here.
I apologize.
There we go.
It's going to go really fast, but I'm not going to get much out of this.
Well, thank you. And for the record, my name is Matt Donegan, and I serve on the Oregon Education Investment Board. I also have been recently asked to chair the Governance and Policy Committee of that board. So what I will review today is a recommendation that I plan to share with the full OEIB tomorrow. That's been the result of several weeks' worth of work with the committee that I've been chairing. And I'm sad to say we just took a very dry presentation and made it even drier, because the kind of the interesting, you know, part, which is a lot more student-centered, was the earlier part of the presentation. We're really going to just jump right into the org charts and talk to you about, you know, redesign, and so here we have it. I will turn your attention to the PowerPoint that is being projected. There's a lot to look at, and I guess it's relative. Compared to the current system, it's actually not that much to look at. This is a significantly streamlined, simplified organizational design, believe it or not, relative to what we currently have. And maybe the simplest way to kind of walk you through this is really on a left-right basis. So if you start on the left side at the top, and you'll see up there, it's really trying to describe what the role of the state is. And the state we're defining in terms of education delivery, the role of the state is one of active and strategic investment and leadership. That's as much intended to describe what it's not, what its role isn't, as much as what the role is. And so really what the role of the state is not is one of micromanagement and education delivery. Education delivery is on the right side of the chart, which is really the role of the schools, of the education providers. And then if you look at this the gold in the middle, this is a glue, the achievement compacts, that's really trying to establish mutual expectations between the state on the left and the school providers, the education providers on the right. So again, if you think about the starting place of what we're proposing here, it's the state on the left in this role of of investment and leadership, the schools on the right providing delivery. It's really critical that this is not a typical vertical chart, which you typically see drawn, where the state is at the top with this super board, the OEIB, that's intending to run the entire education system. This is explicitly a rejection of that model, and much more of the schools on the right, again, in a partnership with the state, where the state is really focusing on what it should do well, which is strategic investment and leadership. And the schools doing what they do well, which is education delivery. So I'll start with that kind of broad architecture here, and that's very profound, and then build out the rest of it. I'll start again on the left. As you look at really what the apparatus of the state is, what the recommendation is that you'll see the legislature and the governor, again, representing the state up at the top. It says OEIC, that's a typo. It should be OEIB, Oregon Education Investment Board. It's not exactly a typo. There's been iterations. It's gone back and forth. This is an old iteration. My apologies. It's OEIB, Oregon Education Investment Board, on which I serve and to which Dr. Crew to my right reports. And so the idea here would be the OEIB, under Rudy's leadership, would then lead an organization that would be comprised of the Department of Education, which you see in the center. Under that, Early Learning Council and K-12. Over to the left, OEIB staff, and then over to the right, a newly created Department of Post-Secondary Education. I just want to make this very, very clear. What this is anticipating is the formation of a new Department of Post-Secondary Education, and then the early learning function in K-12, both residing within K-12. Very importantly, what you'll see is these, and this is color-coded, hopefully this is clear enough, but you'll see the ELC and that OSEC and the HEC. These are all basically components of the OEIB. So right now, these are disparate commissions, councils, and what they're intended to be is aligned. So this is intended to really streamline and align the organization of the states of the state on the right.
The only note I'll make here, because you're probably wondering about this OSEC, that is a new acronym, and all these names are very, as Matt's typo sort of suggested, they're very much up in the air. But that would really be the today's State Board of Education, focused in its K-12 mission, aligned with the OEIB, with, as Matt suggested, perhaps some partial overlap of membership with, like the Early Learning Council, sort of one hand on the OEIB, helping to advise the OEIB on investments and outcomes, and on the other hand, with some independent jurisdiction, as the State Board has considerable independent jurisdiction today related to standards and curriculum and various rules that the department promulgates.
Okay, Ben and Matt, we do have a question. Co-Chair Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I noticed that they're color-coded, which is helpful. Can you help me understand why the Department of Education and the Department of Post-Secondary Education are broken apart if we're kind of creating a unity and a streamlined system? And who do they report to? Is there a new Rob Saxton of the Department of Post-Secondary Education? Does he serve both, or is there a second Rob Saxton at the Department of Post-Secondary Education?
I would say it's a very natural question, and that you could certainly take the consolidation a step farther and look at a single department of education that would be inclusive of post-secondary as well. As this is drawn up, and I would anticipate this will be a topic of further debate during the session, and I think it's a very legitimate, natural question is, you know, if you're really looking for integration, why wouldn't you take that next step and look at a single Department of Education that would be inclusive of post-secondary? This was drawn up that with a to envision, yes, a counterpart to Rob Saxon at the Department of Post-Secondary Education.
I want to follow up if you don't
follow up. Just a really brief follow-up. I guess the distinction is, right now, my understanding of the Department of Education and the State Board of Education is that it is integrated between K-12 and early childhood and community colleges and workforce. So why are we stepping away to break them? So you say we could go one step further and bring them together, but this is actually splitting them apart.
This does include the universities, which the current structure does not. And so what this envisions is, in the Department of Post-Secondary Education, you would have the community colleges and the universities. And then within the Department of Education, you'd have K-12 as well as early learning. And so that does create integration that's not currently in place. And then the HEC is really a group that would be looking at the connectivity between those two, and really in that 10 through 14 grade space, that would further integrate the two departments that are left up there.
So there's a blending. The proposal would be a blending of like the Chancellor's Office and CCWD?
Yes, sir. And OSI.
Yes, Representative
Redding. This would take too long to finally get a good answer from, but I want you to recognize that one of the concerns that I have with that particular chart is that the achievement compacts, as seen by many of the school districts that I deal with, are set up a set of responsibilities for those districts to come up with certain things and be successful with. It's not clear within that chart what the responsibilities are from the OEIB, from the left side of that chart, to the right side of the chart. And that's a real concern, because it appears, and the rhetoric that I've heard in talking with superintendents is that, and other teachers and others, is that there's an expectation that the schools will do certain things, but there's no corresponding expectation that they're going to get something from the other side of the chart except demands.
And capital, obviously, so the state would be providing.
And capital, but not necessarily as much as is needed. So.
No, certainly. So it seems that the essence of the compacts that are intended to, this is intended to depict, obviously the state would be providing capital, would be providing investment, and then the achievement compacts would hopefully clarify what the expectations for those investments are. But I do think further to your point, is that the state is actually, and this is why the state is not intended or envisioned here to be a passive investor that's just simply providing capital. It's actually the terms active strategic investment and leadership is intended to connote that the state would actually be providing some value-added services as well. Those are, frankly, to be built out a little bit further, and I'll show you the starting point for that building out a little bit later. Just to spend one moment on the right side of the chart, but I think the point's very well taken. On the right side of the chart, a couple things to point out. Number one is this does envision, there's a lot of focus right now in post-secondary because of the formation of the HEC and therefore the questions and also the institutional boards at University of Oregon and Portland State. So I think there's a lot of attention around post-secondary education, but this is not intended to be exclusive of K-12, just the opposite. This is intended to be a single structure that would serve all education in Oregon. And so what you see on the right side of the chart is basically all the schools. You can see broken out K-12, community colleges. What the blue indicates is a board, is a governing board. And so what you see that this is suggesting is that down at the bottom, Portland State would have a newly created governing board, University of Oregon, likewise, alongside OHSU, and that the five remaining universities, or what you see under OUS, would also be governed by a single board. But I think the The mission of that board would shift really towards university governance. So this is intended to suggest OUS essentially be one university, but in five parts, if you will. It's just, I'm also the chairman of the Board of Higher Education, and that's somewhat akin to how we already think of it. It's essentially a seven-part system. This would be a five-part system. To the far right,
Co-Chair Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Did you just say that OUS would become one university with satellites?
No.
They're called hubs.
I heard you say one university.
Well, that is somewhat akin to the language that we use already within the Board of Higher Education and OUS, is that we are a seven-part university system. This is intended to suggest it's a five-part university system, but that the focus of that board and of that system would no longer have the functions that are now over in the Department of Post-Secondary Education. I think that's the main point, is that as the Department of Post-Secondary Education is now taking up the functions of investment, of program approvals, those would no longer be the domain of OUS. OUS would now really be focusing on university management and governance.
Just say that. As the representative from Corvallis, the phrasing of that was interesting.
Yeah, no, I certainly didn't mean for it to intend to communicate more than what I just said.
Matt, I'm truly sorry. I think we've ended up coming up with more questions than answers, and we probably needed a whole hour just for this, but we've got about 2 minutes left.
I can probably finish up right on this page, and what you'll see is seven objectives that were addressed through this recommendation, and you'll hopefully fairly clear language around the recommendations here. So I think hopefully we can provide the rest of the PowerPoint, and it would hopefully would stand alone. With regard to just finishing out this chart, I just draw your attention to the lower right, which is the shared services enterprise. You'll see TBD, which that is quite deliberate, which is to say that this is a very early stage concept. The idea being is this has just been something that's gnawed on a lot of folks as you think about Portland State, University of Oregon, potentially getting their own boards and breaking off from the system. I don't think there's anybody that's looking for that to result in a loss of economies of scale, you know, redundant services, IT back offices and waste. I think there's pretty much a shared desire to retain the economies of scale and actually improve in those economies of scale and potentially extrapolate that to the community colleges and maybe even K-12. We just didn't have the time within our subcommittee to really address that and do it the work that it really deserves. So we intend to tee that up for further exploration. The thought would be, you know, maybe there is a shared services enterprise that can provide all those back office services, help the institution save a buck and improve quality through best practices. So in closing, I think the question is that we often face is, you know, what happens to the university system? What happens to the chancellor's office? This does envision a restructuring with three major destinations. Destination one would be the Department of Post-Secondary Education, as I mentioned. The investment and the academic approval functions would shift to the Department of Post-Secondary Education and be merged with community colleges. The second destination would be, as I said, the OUS over on the right side of the chart, which would be, again, more of a focus towards managing this five-part university system. And then the third is potentially the destination would be the shared services enterprise, which would, again, be providing a lot of the back office and support for all the institutions. Whatever remaining time.
You're awesome. And I apologize again. I think we're always too ambitious. We want to get a lot of information let, and we overfill the calendar. Representative Dimbro did want to let everybody know that if you want more information, there will be additional meeting regarding the higher ed portion of this in the higher ed committee on Wednesday at 2 p.m. And so check the schedule and find out. And Matt will be there. And maybe we'll give you more than 10 minutes, Matt.
Well,
we'll lobby them to do so.
I had 25 slides. I got through one.
Thanks again,
Dr.
Fu.
Track, right?
Ben, thank you very much. I'm going to close the informational meeting on the update on the governor's education agenda. And I'm going to open a public information meeting and invite Rob Saxton up and give us an update from the Department of Education. And you now have 3 minutes, but no, I'm kidding.
Seven
you
and
have,
a half.
You have four.
Exactly. Good afternoon, Chair Huffman, Chair Delzer. It's nice to see you all this afternoon, and I actually will be really as brief as I possibly can because I know it's tight and that 4 o'clock is sort of the turn into a pumpkin deadline. So last time I was in front of you, I think I was on the, I had been in this position for 40 days, and now I have a whopping 115, so I'm feeling pretty seasoned. If you can't figure it out in 100 days, it's time to move on. So certainly a lot of work. I'm going to just cover some really high points, and if you have any questions and there's some time left, I'd like to hit on those too. Last time I was here, I talked about some of the key leadership changes that have been made in the department. One key leadership change in the department since that time, and that's the addition of Sarah Pope, who previously was with Stanford Children and also with OBA, who's now acting as my deputy and is here in the audience today and is doing a great job and a terrific addition to the department. We're working very diligently with districts on Senate Bill 290 and also 252 around educator effectiveness. That work is going very well. Districts will kick off their pilots in July, and districts are really close, many districts really close to having that work done, and we're looking forward to seeing, well, we're involved in it and seeing that. We're leading a lot of that work, and it's just going very well, but having people complete those plans so that other districts can get a look and begin to use some of the very best work that's been done so far across the state. We're working hard on supporting our focus and priority schools. Again, that work, I think, is going very well. We've had good internal reviews by those districts and also some external reviews, and the plans are underway in those districts, and looking forward to seeing the student successes very soon. Working on the report card redesign, and so that work is well underway. David Edwards is leading that, a previous colleague of yours, and I'm feeling really good about how that's going. We should be able to see some drafts of that by mid-March, and I think that people will be pleased. There's a big public engagement process that's going along with that, and again, I think it's really good work. We have been working very diligently on putting together a strategic plan in the Department of Education. I haven't been able to find one previously. A person who absolutely has to have a strategic plan in place and some good metrics around that strategic plan and work towards that in a very diligent way. We'll make sure that it ties in with the work that OEIB is doing. I think it will be very important. I know we've reached out to a number of, well, all of you, and on some input around that, and I can tell you that it is very important work as we move forward, and it will really drive the work of the department. So I'm looking forward to having that done. We should have that finished in January, and the key components of it ready to go in about a week and a half. The I am convening an ESD group. Just real quickly, the people who are being convened with that are Mark Woody from John Day, Ben Bergreen from Phoenix Talent, Shelley Berman from Eugene, who are all superintendents from disparate parts of the state and disparate size districts, Karen Patton from Wallowa ESD, Scott Perry, Southern Oregon, and James Sager from the Northwest Regional. Again, these six people are very well respected. They're from different ESDs, or different parts of the state and different sized groups. I did say when I was here last time that I wanted to be able to report to you that the relationship between the department and the Autism Commission has improved. I will leave that up to the Autism Commission and or folks to verify that that's the case, but I do think it is absolutely the case, and we've looked at the recommendations made by that group and done some staff development on those at the Special Education Conference and Eugene a couple different times and began implementing some of those, and so I believe that that is really coming along nicely. We are working diligently around various issues of the department, including direction and morale. We've got a new mission statement in place, and I won't go through that with you now, but we're very pleased about that. We have an audit beginning underway from PSU and Phil Kiesling as we look at reorganizing the department, making sure that we're being efficient as we possibly can. So we're doing that both internally and then also an external review so that we make sure that we turn over every stone to be as efficient as we possibly can as a department. I would tell you that being a support agency as well as one of compliance has become very important to us, and we're working hard on de-siloing the department as part of that reorganization. Been on visits all across the state. I'm not going to give you a list of different places I've been, although I have them all here. I will tell you that last week on Wednesday, I was, there's been so many places I can't even hardly tell you. Wednesday I was in Astoria, Wednesday night, and then the next night I was in Medford. So that sort of gives you an idea of the distance, and then Eugene the next day after that. Talking about the work that we have underway, both as a department, the initiatives that Dr. Crew talked about in greater detail than I will here, and then also a little bit about the governor's budget and the work that we're doing. I've also had an opportunity to get engaged at the national level, which is really important as we bring on the Common Core standards. Spent a couple of days in Savannah, Georgia with the Chief Council of State School Officers, which is really important work as we make sure that we are a significant player on that stage as that gets rolled out across the nation, the Smarter Balance Assessment Test. And tomorrow I arrive in Vegas at 7:30 a.m. and leave at 9:30, so it should be a really wild time as we work on the Smarter Balance Assessment Test. Sounds like a great day. And so that's some of the work that is underway. We are moving as absolute fast as we can. I know that the session is swiftly moving and will be upon us before I even can think about it. And so I appreciated very much the comments of Representative Gelzer earlier and took those to heart about we need to have things in place and be ready to go by the time, as soon as we possibly can. Some of that by the time the session starts and some of it very swiftly once the session convenes. If there are any questions, that was a lot and in no depth at all.
Thank you for the rush. And you and Rudy and I have had a conversation. I said that I would be the one in the legislature to convince about the direction you're going with ESDs. I think the message was clear today. Now there are others that are very interested in the direction of where we're looking at taking ESDs. So I was glad you were at least sitting here and listening to the conversation. And Representative Comp, you're the one that wanted out by 403. And so if you have a question, go right ahead.
Yes, thank you. And thanks to the committee. In the past, in assessments, the name of the game, we're all impacted by it. In the past, the department, the question is, are you auditing past practices of assessment contracts to make sure that we're not out of compliance with our assessment tools as we have been in the past?
Representative Huffman, Representative Comp. Yes, we are doing that. We're looking at the contracts that we have and making sure that we're going to be squared away as we move forward with the possibility of Smarter Balanced.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Gelzer.
Thank you. You've been busy. On the ESD group, will there be a way for ESDs that are not part of the OAESD and their component districts to weigh in? I'm meeting with about 12 such superintendents in the morning, and they will ask me that question.
Yes. Yes, Co-Chair Gelzer, one of the people that I mentioned in my comments was the superintendent from Lilawa ESD, Karen Patton. And Karen, her ESD is not a member of the OAESD, and it was important for me to make sure that there was at least one member of the six that was not a member of OAESD. Both Lilawa and Lynn Benton Lincoln are not members. And when I looked at trying to look at different spaces across the state and then also small, Karen actually serves three purposes: small, Eastern, million-dollar floor, and not a member of the OAESD. So it was really important. Actually, I looked really hard at LBL and know that it would be great to have somebody there, but in sort of fairness, Karen fit a lot of the needs of that committee.
That works well, and I'll share that tomorrow.
Thank you.
And thank you for your phenomenal work at the department. It's been great to watch.
My pleasure.
It really has been
a pleasure to do the work. And I should also tell you, just in relationship with that, it's been a real pleasure for me to get to know and work with Dr. Crew. as we move forward in this and his partnership as we do this work. We had our teams together today, and we're meeting on a monthly basis and making sure that we're really doing a nice job of coordinating and communicating that. And part of the reason that we're on a push around our strategic plan is to make sure that it folds very well in with OEIB and it all fits together when we're done.
Thanks so much, Rob. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the informational meeting on the update from the department, and we are adjourned.
Well done, sir.